From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Former Army Sergeant Eric Saar was a translator at Guantanamo Bay, where he witnessed the sexual humiliation of a detainee by a female interrogator. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Saar about what he saw, whether it was part of a larger policy, and why he's coming forward now with the story. And we'll talk with Time Magazine Washington correspondent Vivica Novak. The two collaborated on the new book, Inside the Wire. Also, we talk with Amy Sherman Palladino, the creator and executive producer of the WB series The Gilmore Girls, about a single mother and her daughter who are best friends. The third season just came out on DVD. And critic at large John Powers tells us about the Japanese animated TV series Paranoia Agent, which is also out on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eric Saar, witnessed the use of sexual interrogation tactics at the detention facility for suspected terrorists in Guantanamo Bay, often referred to as Gitmo, which was opened in January of 2002. Saar worked as an Arabic translator at Guantanamo for 6.5 months, beginning in December of 2002. His first job there was translating the detainees' day-to-day communications with the guards and military personnel. Then he translated interrogations and intelligence documents. He's written a new book about what he witnessed at Guantanamo called Inside the Wire. Also joining us is Saar's co-author Vivica Novak, a Washington correspondent for Time magazine who covers legal affairs, terrorism, and civil liberties. Saar asked her to collaborate with him after reading a story she'd written on Guantanamo. Well, Eric Saar, let's start with what is probably the most extreme example of interrogation in your book. And this was translating for a Saudi prisoner who was being interrogated by a woman in the American military. What was the goal of this interrogation? What kind of information were they looking for from this prisoner?
Terry, this was a prisoner that was uncooperative in the past, but as the intelligence team had been confronted with information regarding this individual, that made us believe that he had connections to terrorism, and he had been uncooperative for a long period of time since he'd been confronted with that information. And that evening, the intent of this interrogation was to humiliate this detainee and to create a barrier through sexual humiliation and sexual enticement between the detainee and his faith and his religion, because the interrogator believed that this individual was returning to his cell and somehow gaining strength from his personal relationship with his religion and with his faith. And the intent was to create a wedge or a divide between the detainee and that relationship. In one instance, wiping red ink on the detainee's face, which he believed was menstrual blood, in an attempt to make him feel as though he was unclean. So according to the interrogator's beliefs regarding Islam, that he would then be unable to go back to his cell and pray.
Well, the first thing this interrogator did in terms of sexual humiliation, I mean, he would have interpreted it as sexual humiliation. She rubbed her breasts against him. Would you describe like what she did and what his reaction was?
Yes, ma'am. She was wearing a tight brown T-shirt, and she took off this outer top and was trying to tempt him, and turned around and rubbed her chest on his back. The idea was that because he was going to be attracted to her and aroused by her, she said to him, you know, how do you feel about being attracted to an American infidel? That somehow he was then supposed to have a certain amount of guilt that went along with that feeling, that made him feel as though he wasn't being a true Muslim.
Then she took a break from the interrogation and talked to a translator who was Muslim.
Yes, ma'am.
And developed a different tactic. What was that, and what do you know about what their interaction was like? Were you overhearing them?
I did overhear them, and the question was from her to the Muslim linguist was, what else can I do to create this sort of wedge and make him feel as though he cannot return to his cell and pray? And she was instructed to, or she was given the advice of suggesting, telling the detainee that she was menstruating. So then we went one step further, and when we returned to the interrogation booth, that was when the example of wiping the red ink on the detainee's face and telling him that it was menstrual blood, that's where that occurred.
And what was his reaction to that?
His reaction was violent. He came out of his chains. One of his ankle shackles came loose. He spit at us. He was screaming. And I believe that was, in a way, the reaction that she was looking for.
You say it was this interrogator's goal to create a wedge between this Saudi prisoner and his religion, because she thought he was getting strength and sustenance from his faith. Was it part of policy at Guantanamo to keep people from their faith? Because there's been, you know, we've been told that every effort has been made to let them let the Muslims pray several times a day. The call to prayer is given over the loudspeakers. Every Muslim is given a copy of the Quran to have in the cell with them.
Right.
I mean, and you know, the Bush administration is so pro-faith. So Is this idea of creating a wedge between a prisoner and his faith part of policy?
Well, everything you mentioned, ma'am, is correct, and all of that does exist in the general population. But what I'm referring to are tactics that were used in the interrogation booth with certain detainees that I think normally rose to the level of a pretty significant priority. So that was where, and I do believe that it was a matter of policy to use these techniques. They weren't hidden from anyone. A number of individuals knew that sex was used as a weapon in the interrogation booth to interfere with this relationship. So on one hand, ma'am, there was a concerted effort, and I do think by and large, as a camp, the camp as a whole attempted to provide an environment where the detainees can practice their faith. And all of the concessions that you mentioned were indeed, they were definitely there. I'm not denying that. But the fact that in the interrogation booth, we determined that it was appropriate to use these tactics, which I would also add were entirely ineffective. And actually, a number of individuals and a number of professionals on the island outside of the military also complained about these tactics. For example, the recently declassified FBI emails cite that not only are these tactics unethical, but they're ineffective.
So, Terry, if I could jump in, there's a passage in the book where Eric, we describe Eric's reaction to this meeting where all the intelligence personnel, the interrogators, and the linguists were called in. And there was a lawyer, a JAG lawyer from Washington, who had come down and had a PowerPoint presentation. And he was explaining to them, why the Geneva Conventions did not apply to these detainees. A very unusual meeting for the Army to hold because, as Eric says, the military doesn't do explainers. They just tell you what's going to happen. And this was kind of the signal that, this was a huge deal for interrogations and the old rules didn't apply. But the problem was nobody knew what the new rules were and nobody had experience with new rules because all Army interrogators are trained, they have it hammered into their heads that they are to abide by the Geneva Conventions. And, I think that's where a lot of the problems started. And even at Abu Ghraib, where conditions were much, much worse, I think, the detainees there were supposed to be covered by the Geneva Conventions. And yet, why did the things happen that happened there? I think it was, largely because of the confusion that had been sowed by the various directives on the handling of detainees at Gitmo.
Vivica, the story that we just heard about the female interrogator who used her sexuality as a tool in the interrogation, the chapter about that was there was an attempt to remove it from the book when an early draft was submitted to the military, as Eric Saar was required to do. First of all, if you could just explain why he had to submit the book and then just like describe why officials asked for it to be taken out?
Well, he submitted it, actually, even before we met, he submitted an early version of an account of his memories from Guantanamo. He had signed an agreement, as other soldiers in this world are required to sign, saying he wouldn't reveal classified information. And it isn't always clear what's classified information, so he had submitted this to see what would be allowed. In the end, we got permission to publish, the account of this interrogation. But what happened is that I think early on, and we didn't find this out until later, but early on, the officials down at Guantanamo had wanted to disallow publicizing this anecdote. And in Washington, the office that is responsible for the final sign-off on this kind of thing went back to them and said, are you sure that, you can come up with a good legal reason to prohibit this from being published? The only reason we know that is that somebody, some disgruntled Pentagon person, I guess, leaked this account, 9 pages of what Eric had submitted, to an AP reporter who in January of this year published the account of this interrogation. And we learned through that the pages she had gotten had a slip of paper attached to it from Pentagon headquarters in Washington, you know, writing to the people at Gitmo saying, are you sure that you have the legal authority to redact this material? And that's when we learned that originally they had not wanted this to be published.
And also, Terry, I'll add that in fairness, I should say that when the Pentagon's version, when they're vetting in their vetting process and determining what is and is not classified, their only mission is to determine what is and is not classified. So they don't concur with they try to make it very clear when they give the document back. In fairness, I should say that they're just saying that this is not classified. They're not saying taking an opinion on the issues per se.
Right. So the fact that they're letting you publish something doesn't necessarily mean that they agree that it happened.
It just means that they don't think they could defend their decision to redact it if they were sued.
Eric Saar, do you care to speculate how high up in the chain people knew about some of the more extreme methods of interrogation at Guantanamo?
Well, Terry, I do know from my colleagues that they had no reason to doubt that individuals very high up the chain of command knew, especially some of the extreme techniques that were being employed, because they have certain measures that they have to take as interrogators to get approval for those techniques. I mean, this isn't something where a junior soldier just walks into an interrogation booth and says, this is the tactic I'm going to use today, and whatever I think looks good, I'm going to kind of freelance, because they have policies and directives that they have to follow, and they know full well that if they choose not to follow those, there are far-reaching ramifications to that decision.
My guests are Eric Saar, who worked as an Arabic translator at the detention facility for suspected terrorists in Guantanamo Bay, and Time magazine correspondent Vivica Novak. Their new book is called Inside the Wire. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Eric Saar and Vivica Novak, co-authors of the new book Inside the Wire, and it's about military interrogations at Guantanamo. Eric Saar worked as an Arabic translator and military intelligence specialist at the detention facility in Guantanamo for 6.5 months, starting in December of 2002. Vivica Novak is a reporter for Time magazine, where she writes about legal affairs, terrorism, and civil liberties. Now, Eric, I want to make clear that you say, you know, this interrogation that you just described, where the interrogator used her sexuality as a tool to try to get the Saudi prisoner to talk, was not typical. And you give an example of a woman interrogator who you thought was really excellent and had a real mm-hmm. gift for getting prisoners to speak to her with a degree of comfort. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about what her technique was?
Yes, ma'am. That was a different government agency that happened to be working on the island. And I do want to be very clear that this was not something that everyone who was at Gitmo participated in, and that, you know, were down there on a regular basis abusing prisoners. That's really not what I'm saying. There were elements within our government that disagreed with these tactics. And a civilian agency chose to employ different interrogation methods. And actually, they really didn't even refer to them as interrogations. They called them interviews. And they were attempting to build a rapport with the detainee and establish a certain level of trust, whereby they would then be able to get the detainee to at least begin talking. And when that occurs, at least the interviewer or the interrogator has the opportunity to exploit the information being passed to him or her.
Would you describe what her technique was?
Her technique was simply to build rapport with the detainee, to establish a level of trust, to try to find some commonality and understand the culture of where the detainee grew up, to understand his family, his background, and thereby get him to begin to talk to her and then exploit his information.
What are some of the other things you witnessed during interrogations that struck you as extreme techniques in either being overly coercive, overly painful so as to be or to approach torture? Can you describe some of the other things that you think crossed the line?
I could say some of the examples of interrogations I participated in, and then others I knew about through my colleagues who both worked in interrogations and translated interrogations. I could say that in general, in the broad scope of the fear-up approach of where an interrogator was putting a detainee in a stress position, meaning that he was chained to the floor and forced to hunch over and exposed to cold temperatures and exposed to sleep deprivation and things of that nature. I mean, I think that overall, all of these factors or all of these circumstances for me are what created the picture that this was un-American. But maybe for some listening, more importantly, I might want to also point out that these are tactics that were ineffective. I mean, one of the things that was enormously frustrating to me as a soldier and as someone who had some experience in intelligence was that we had a cadre of individuals on the island, including, for example, FBI special agents, who had an enormous amount of experience in the intelligence community and had been working in counterterrorism, some individuals for a decade, because they had been working on counterterrorism since the first World Trade Center bombing. And these were individuals who disagreed with the use of these tactics, saying, look, this doesn't need to be these tactics don't need to be employed, and in fact, they're counterproductive. If in later interrogations we want to go back and somehow try to build a relationship with this detainee, you've now burned that bridge, so we can't do that. So there were a number of factors that really contributed to me reaching the decisions that I made.
There have been reports of a lot of suicide attempts on the part of detainees at Guantanamo. Did you see a lot of suicide attempts while you were there?
I did see the results of a number of suicide attempts, and we responded on the first team that I was on when I dealt with the detainees on a daily basis to suicide attempts fairly regularly, to be honest with you. And when I contrasted what I saw in terms of how many suicide attempts we responded to as linguists to the public affairs information that was coming out of Guantanamo Bay regarding how many actual suicide attempts there were, the numbers definitely didn't match up. And I realized later during my time at Guantanamo Bay that the reason for that was because the Pentagon had determined that a number of these examples that I would term as suicide attempts, they ended up not calling them suicide attempts because they referred to them as something called self-injurious manipulative behavior.
And what does the manipulative mean in self-injurious manipulative behavior? That they're injuring themselves to get attention or to evoke sympathy?
That was the perception to us, that they decided to stop categorizing them as suicide attempts because they believed that the detainees were attempting to manipulate the system. Some of them wanted to go to isolation, they believed. Some of them, they thought, just wanted more attention from the mental health professionals. So they said these weren't valid suicide attempts. They were really attempts where they had no chance whatsoever of really killing themselves. Therefore, they determined that they should label them as something else.
And did you think that there was, at the very least, an element of truth to that?
An element of truth in the sense that some of the attempts were feeble because of the means in which detainees had to use to try to kill themselves. In other words, they were really trying to rig they were trying to hang themselves, and it was very difficult for them to do that. So in terms of the military's argument that they didn't really have a very good chance of actually killing themselves, that might have some credibility. But whether or not they really intended or would have hoped to kill themselves, I don't think is something that the military really could ascertain.
A lot of the prisoners have been sent back to their countries from Guantanamo. What were some of the reasons for releasing them?
I'll answer this, and then maybe Vivica can actually add a little bit, probably based on her background. But I believe, from my experience, I think a number of them were released because we didn't know why they had ever been picked up. And the government has said that they're no longer a threat to the United States. But to be honest with you, as someone who spent time there, I don't know that they were ever a threat to the United States. And I think we had a number of individuals when I was there, even shortly after I joined the intelligence team in February of 2003, that we knew, despite the fact that the camp had only been open a little over a year, we already knew that they were individuals that we were going to end up sending back to their home country because we couldn't ascertain that they were picked up on the battlefield, and we didn't know that they actually posed a threat to us, and we found no holes in their story. But I don't know, maybe Vivica could add other reasons why they may have been sent home.
Well, what I found as a reporter kind of following this was, you know, I had various sources who were talking to me off the record. from the Pentagon and elsewhere, intelligence sources, who are saying that, you know, a number of these detainees are now on the list, a growing list, of individuals who should be sent back, who we really, you know, don't need to be holding. But they weren't released, and their, you know, releases kept being postponed. And, you know, people started telling me that, you know, it was for political reasons, that it didn't look good to have a big release of you know, 100 detainees. That wouldn't look good for the administration because it would show so dramatically how many were picked up in error. And things were just, you know, they were dragged out and dragged out. And it took, you know, the Supreme Court case that was decided in June of last year for the Pentagon to be forced to give these detainees a chance in federal court to bring their case, to challenge their detentions. And I would also, I wanted to add to something Eric said before about, you know, we've been talking about these different interrogation techniques and the different sorts of things that the detainees were put through. I think we're also losing sight of perhaps the most extreme form of abuse that we put these people through, which was the psychological torture of not knowing your fate. We're keeping these people for years. They never know if they're going to see a lawyer. They didn't know if they were going to be charged with anything. Many of them didn't know why they were there. But just that open-endedness is, I think, very, very tough on the psyche.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Eric Saar and Vivica Novak co-authored the new book about Guantanamo, Inside the Wire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin. Available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, committed to enriching the arts, culture, and historic heritage of the Philadelphia region at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Amy Sherman Palladino, the creator and executive producer of the popular WBTV series Gilmore Girls, about a mother and daughter who are best friends. And John Powers tells us about the Japanese animated TV series Paranoia Agent, one of the best and strangest programs he's ever seen. It's out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Fresh Air critic Ken Tucker's book about what he loves and hates about television, he singles out the WB series Gilmore Girls as having one of the best mothers in TV history. The series is about a single mother and her teenage daughter who are best friends. My guest, Amy Sherman Palladino, created the series, is an executive producer, and has written many of the episodes. Gilmore Girls is popular for its relationships, its witty, fast-paced dialogue, and its constant references to popular culture. The mother in Gilmore Girls, Lorelai Gilmore, got pregnant when she was 16, decided to have the baby, and not marry the father.
Although she's lucky to have a great relationship with her daughter, Rory, she never had a good relationship with her own parents. They're wealthy, and Lorelai thinks of them as snobbish and selfish. But she's beholden to them for funding Rory's prep school education and loaning her the money for Yale. Gilmore Girls is in its fifth season. The third season has just come out on DVD. In this scene from the third season, Rory has just come home to Connecticut after spending the summer in Washington, D.C. Lorelai is played by Lauren Graham. Rory is played by Alexis Bledel.
I'm so glad to see you.
No, I'm glad to see you.
I'm never leaving home again.
Oh, that's my emotionally stunted girl. Hey, I got you gifts.
What? I'm the one that left town. I'm supposed to get you gifts.
Oh, but I got here early and there was nothing to do except feed gummy bears to the bomb-sniffing dogs, which apparently the United States government frowns upon.
You got in trouble with the government while you were waiting for me?
Just a little.
How much is a little?
Learn Russian. Okay, here you go.
Wow, a Hartford, Connecticut sweatshirt.
Nice, huh?
Hartford, Connecticut notebook, Hartford, Connecticut pencil set, Hartford, Connecticut shot glass.
And beer mug.
Hartford baguette, Hartford bear, Hartford sunglasses.
You like?
I love.
All right, let's go. We'll get your bags and we'll hit the road. And then I can't wait to hear all about Washington. And by the way, I got you out of dinner with the Gilmores tonight. I thought you and Dean might enjoy a little peaches and herb time together.
Oh, thanks. What'd you tell him?
That you get home tomorrow.
Big fat lie.
Yes, which proves how much I love you. The fact that I was willing to lie to my own parents, who I never lied to, just so you could have a night of happiness, is proof positive of my deep, undying devotion that I have for you.
I appreciate that.
Before creating Gilmore Girls, Amy Sherman-Palladino wrote for Roseanne and Veronica's Closet. I asked her about creating the characters of Lorelai and Rory.
At the time that I put Gilmore on the air, teenage girls on television, in my view, were reflected in sort of two categories. They were the pretty cheerleaders who were popular but secretly anorexic, or they were the angry, dark-haired, Doc Martin-wearing disenfranchised girls who hate the cheerleaders but secretly want to be the cheerleaders. And there didn't really seem to be any room in the middle. There didn't seem to be any room for the girl who, you know, wasn't having sex at 12 and a half and wasn't dressing like a whore and wasn't, you know, dying to be popular, or there wasn't a girl who was sort of comfortable in her skin and sort of had her life and didn't really belong to any group and was kind of okay with that, and that books and reading and education and her future was the most important thing, way more important than boys. It just felt like, where's the other girl? So it was also a real chance for me to put that other kind of teenager on television. So you almost work backwards from that. What kind of mother has this kind of kid? And it obviously had to be a very smart woman, a very bright woman. You wanted to get them close in age because that's how you sort of bridge that gap. And, you know, Lorelai never felt like her parents understood her, so she wanted to really make sure that this kid felt understood, respected, nurtured, and free to be whoever it was she was going to be.
The Gilmore Girls is famous for its fast and witty dialogue. The dialogue is so fast that from what I've read, there are many, many more pages per episode of The Gilmore Girls than for the average hour-long TV show. So why did you start writing that way, you know, with an emphasis on fast, witty dialogue?
When I'm with my friends, we almost talk over each other. We you know, and especially when there's a connection with somebody and you know them, you can anticipate where they're going. And for somebody like, you know, a mother-daughter like Lorelai and Rory, they almost have the same brain. They're going to finish each other's sentences. It the speed of their speech almost indicates a little bit. It tells me a little bit about who they are and how close they are. I also personally believe that comedy works better fast. I think that all of the comedy that I admire, you know, the Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, you know, there wasn't a space of air between those people talking, and you loved them, and it felt natural and it felt real and it moved and you were energized, and an hour and a half you were boom, you had some entertainment, you went out for a cup of coffee. It was perfect. You know, the old Woody Allen movies, you know, was the same way. You know, people just talked over each other. Sometimes the camera couldn't even get to them. Four lines were off camera. I just personally feel like comedy dies slow.
Another thing that the Gilmore Girls is famous for is lots of references to pop culture, books, movies, TV shows, recordings. Every minute there seems to be a reference to something. So let me just play an example of that. This is from the first season, and Lorelai and her daughter Rory are in the car together talking. Here we go.
Why didn't you mention the dance?
Because I'm not going.
Oh. But why aren't you going?
Because I hate dances.
Good answer. Except you've never actually been to a dance.
So?
So you really have nothing to compare it to.
No, but I can imagine it.
It's true. However, not really, since you've never actually been to one, you're basing all your dance opinions on one midnight viewing of 16 Candles.
So?
So you should have a decent reason for hating something before you really decide you hate it.
Trust me, I'll hate it. It'll be stuffy and boring, and the music will suck, and since none of the kids at school like me, I'll be standing in the back listening to 98 Degrees, watching Tristan and Paris argue over which one of them gets to make me miserable first.
Okay. Or it'll be all sparkly and exciting, and you'll be standing on the dance floor listening to Tom Waits with some great-looking guy staring at you so hard that you don't even realize that Paris and Tristan have just been eaten by bears.
What guy?
Okay, so we got at least two different songs in there, plus a movie. And those are the more overt references. I mean, like in one episode that I think you wrote, Lorelai is, I think she's at her parents' like recommitment ceremony. Mm-hmm. And there's a photographer coming and someone says, oh, the photographer's coming. And she says, I am a camera. Christopher Isherwood reference. And then in a recent episode, Lorelai's boyfriend is changing his mind about something. And she says, my mother, my daughter, my mother, my daughter, a reference to Chinatown. So, you know, the references are sometimes overt and sometimes, you know, they just go by and you don't even know if it's a reference or not. So how did you start just kind of sticking in so many? How did it become a thing?
Well, you know, it became a thing accidentally. It wasn't, you know, I didn't sit out to say, and we're going to be the pop culture reference show. You know, here's my card. It just sort of happened. It came out of, you know, these are modern girls, you know, references are all around them. they read a lot. They listen to a lot of music. They watch a lot of movies. They watch a lot of television. And it's just, you know, it's going to seep into their vocabulary. It's going to be part of their brain. I personally talk like that a little bit. And then it just got fun. You know, the most fun was when, because the studio network have been so great about it, but they did once ask me to take out an Oscar Levant reference because they said, no one here knows who Oscar Levant is, and no one on the WB, watching the WB, is going to know who Oscar Levant is. And I said, maybe three kids are going to go back and find out who Oscar Levant is. They're going, there's not three kids who are going to know who Oscar Levant is. And I was like, I won't take it out. And I fought so hard for my Oscar Levant reference, and I won. And I felt so empowered that I just figured, oh, now all bets are off. Now it's open season, and we just really enjoy it. We don't even think about it. And sometimes we wind up taking references out because by the time the scripts are done, it's like, it's holy moly, that's a lot of references. So we wind up stripping some of them out.
One of Rory's friends, Lane, is a character who really loves music and pop culture, and she kind of defines herself and other people by their taste in pop culture. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about creating her?
Well, she defines people definitely by their taste in music. Lane is based on my best friend, Helen Pye, much to Helen's chagrin. Helen is this adorable Korean girl who was raised in a very traditional Korean, very strict Seventh-day Adventist home. And she was purely an American kid. Rock and roll, Duran Duran fetish, just really like as rock and roll as they come. But she was raised in a household that didn't allow rock music or dancing or jewelry or, you know, very, very strict. And she had to sort of carve out a secret life for herself. She had all of her posters were up in her closet because she couldn't put them out because she couldn't have her parents see them. So, and she loves her parents very much and respects her parents very much. So this hiding, this music obsession was not about rebelling. It was about trying to be respectful, but still trying to have a little bit of her own self. And I always loved that concept because Helen has one of the best relationships with her parents of anyone I've ever met. She sees them all the time. She just adores them. And I wanted to do something similar when I created Lane. And then eventually, of course, she grew up, so it all came out, and now she's in a band. And, you know, Lane is one of those people that really, music is her life, and good music, quality music. That's basically what Lane is. And Lane was became our real music focus of the show, to really get sort of our music opinions out there in the world.
My guest is Amy Sherman Palladino, creator of the WB series Gilmore Girls. Here's a scene from season 2 when the character Lane finds her calling.
I'm going to be a drummer.
You're kidding.
I went into that new music store today. I don't know why I went in. I just had to. Something told me. Lane Kim, there's something in there that you need to see. And there it was. And it was red and shiny and so excited I can't breathe.
That's amazing.
I know.
But how are you going to do this?
I don't know.
How are you going to buy a drum set?
I don't know.
And even if you do buy a drum set, where are you going to play it?
I don't know. I don't know any of this, but I will figure something out, because I am Keith Moon. I am Neil Peart. I am Rick Allen, with and without the arm, because I am rock and roll, baby. I'll call you later.
Amy Sherman Palladino will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Sherman Palladino. She's the creator and executive producer of The Gilmore Girls. She's also done a lot of the writing for the show. We've been talking about the relationship of the mother and the daughter on your series. What about your relationship with your mother? What has that relationship been like? Would you compare it to any of the characters on the show?
My upbringing was very, very different. I my father's a comic. My mother was a musical comedy Broadway dancer who came out here and then had a children's theater group and trained me a lot in that. And she's now got her one-woman show, and she's back out there strutting her stuff. So I grew up in a much different sort of, a little bit more hippie sort of comic sitting around, you know. I didn't go to college, so education was not at all stressed in my household at all. It was more about, you know, dance class and get to auditions and drama log and things like that. So I think that everybody has universal problems with their parents. And there are times where I have found myself in a Lorelai Emily situation with my mother, simply on the fact that we're having a conversation and we seem to be talking at each other, not to each other. But it's just a completely different situation. My parents are, you know, they're still in the same house that I grew up in, and I just saw them last week, so we're cool.
What are their names? Might we recognize their names?
My dad's name is Don Sherman. My mom's name is Mabin Hughes. My dad is currently King of the Cruise Line. He's Mr. Saturday Night. He does stand up on the cruises, and he's gone like 110, you know, months out of the year. It's astonishing to me. It's great. You know, they travel all over the world, and he's a very, you know, my humor comes from my dad. It comes from flat out from hanging around a house where comics hung out and made each other laugh for a long time. You know, I grew up on this. So it was sort of, you know, I have zero other skills. I have no other way to support myself. So if this didn't pan out, I was in a lot of trouble.
So did your father actually tell you how to tell a joke? Did he actually like criticize you when you would tell a story or a joke and give you suggestions about how to make it sharper?
No. It's something you absorb. You listen. I grew up on, you know, the 2,000-year-old man albums, you know, Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner because my dad had them, you know, and Lenny Bruce because my dad had them, and, you know, Bob Newhart albums because my dad had them, and comics hanging out at my dad's house, and that sort of that Jewish kind of New York rhythm, even though I was, you know, born and raised in the San Fernando Valley, you know, it's something you sort of absorb and you can't get rid of. My dad, however, did teach me that in television, it's all about the pitch. If you go into a room of executives and you make them think you know what the hell you're talking about, even if you don't, you're done. You're golden. And he's absolutely right. You talk a lot. You make them laugh. You leave. You know, maybe they have no idea what you said, but you sure seem sure of yourself. It's worked very well for me.
Is that how you got the Gilmore Girls?
The Gilmore Girls was a complete freaky fluke because I went into a pitch and I had like four ideas very well thought out, you know, and I'm pitching them and they're bored and their eyes are glazing over and they're looking at their watches and they're thinking about their lunch meetings. And then I said, and I have this last idea. It's kind of like, it's like a mother and daughter, but they're more like friends and mother and daughter. And they're like, that's what we want. And that was the pitch. I sold it. And I walked out of the room and I went, I have no idea what that is. I don't know what I sold. What does that mean? Where do they live? What do they do? And people are like, oh, you got to come up with that. So I turned to my husband, who's a writer, and cried. And he says, well, we're going away on vacation. And we went away and we stayed in this beautiful inn in Connecticut, the Mayflower. And it was like, oh, she should work at an inn and she should live in Connecticut. It just all sort of happened on the trip. So it was a very unusual situation.
So you were married to your husband, who is also an executive producer on the Gilmore Girls, before the Gilmore Girls got started?
Yeah. I bagged him early, you know, because got to bag him while your ass is still holding up, you know. As soon as you get that show and you become a little chair-shaped down there, it's not as hard to bag him. But yeah, he's just a genius writer. He was actually on Family Guy at the time that I got Gilmore Girls on the air, and I was so desperate to have some help because my writing style was just very specific, and it was very, and I just saw these stories so clearly, and I always wanted people to break girlfriend stories, not mother-daughter stories, and that was very hard for the writers I had at the time to understand or comprehend. There was a lot of morals being tacked onto the ends. It's like, no, no one needs to learn a lesson here. Let's just entertain people. So I would call my husband over at Family Guy, and I would say, I would break stories with him over the phone while he's working for another company and another show. And God love Fox. They were very nice. They let him write a couple of scripts for me. And, you know, it was very hard that first year without having that help. And the second year, I begged him to leave, and he did. He came over, and he's been with me ever since. And it's just been the greatest working experience of my life.
But you're lucky, because it's not always easy to work with a spouse.
Well, you know, hour long is very different from half hour. Half hour, I think we would have killed each other with sledgehammers a long time ago, because half hour writers sit in this room for hours and hours and hours, and the room smells bad, and they eat in that room, and it's horrible. And in hour long, it's a lot of solitary work. You break your stories, but then you're writing, or you're in an editing room, or you're on stage, or you're in a sound mix. So it's a lot of, there's so much to do in running the show that we can actually go, you know, days and we don't see each other till dinner, you know, and our offices are right next to each other. So it's perfect. It's the perfect working environment. It's absolutely delightful.
Why is an hour show a more solitary experience for writers and producers than a half hour show?
Well, because unfortunately, and I don't agree with this trend, and I think it's not a good trend, the trend on half hours has become get as many possible people together in a room. So there's like these enormous staffs of people, and just have them constantly pitching jokes, and a lot of the scripts, one writer, you know, it used to be you'd break a story, one writer would go off and write a script, and then that script would, when it was done, would come back to the room, and everybody would sort of pitch jokes on it to punch it up. And nowadays, a lot of shows don't even have a writer go off and write a script. They just sit in the room and they write the script together in what's very charmingly called a gangbang. And it's just, it's a lot of voices. And the thing about comedy is, just because you got 20 people in a room, it may mean you have 20 extra jokes, but it doesn't mean that script's going to be any better. If anything, it waters down the process. The more voices there are to pick from, the less focused, I believe, stories and scripts are. And if you look at some of the classic shows, Taxi, Cheers, Mary Tyler Moore, All in the Family, they were smaller staffs, they were more focused voices, and people wrote. So, you know, to me, when I got to hour long, I got to write again. You know, I got to really sit in the, when I was first on Roseanne, it was the old fashioned traditional method of doing sitcom. And by the time I left Roseanne, I was there for 4 years, they were gangbanging every script. So it's to me, you know, so you're breaking a story, but then at the end of the day, you get to go off by yourself. It's you and your computer. And in my case, a lot of old Buffy DVDs, because too much silence makes me crazy. And I just write, and I just write the script by myself, and it's up to me. It's scarier, but it's a lot more satisfying.
Amy Sherman Palladino, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Amy Sherman Palladino is creator, executive producer, and writer for Gilmore Girls, which airs on the WB Tuesday nights. The third season came out on DVD this week. Coming up, a very strange TV series. This is Fresh Air. The Japanese animated TV series Paranoia Agent has come out on DVD, and critic John Power says that it's not only an amazing show, but a good introduction to one of the world's most interesting filmmakers.
When Japanese animation, or anime, first began showing up in American theaters, I frankly wasn't impressed. Every movie seemed to be about some saucer-eyed girl being violated by a critter with tentacles. But as more anime films came to the U.S., it became obvious that Japanese animation isn't just for geeky teenage boys. At its best, it has a sophistication that makes most Hollywood cartoons seem like, well, cartoons. Although the most famous anime filmmaker is Hayao Miyazaki, who made Spirited Away, the most grown-up is just becoming known here. His name is Satoshi Kon, and he largely shies away from the sci-fi and fantasy themes of other anime directors. His stuff isn't about robots. Instead, Kon's work explicitly tackles the crazy anxieties that bubble beneath the seeming politeness of Japanese life. His latest project is a TV series called Paranoia Agent, and it's one of the best and strangest programs I've ever seen. One night, I showed the first episode to friends at a party, and they all clamored to borrow the DVD. The story begins by focusing on a young woman, Tsukiko, who's well known for inventing a Hello Kitty-like character named Moromi, a big-eyed puppy that's become a national obsession. Tsukiko's under pressure to come up with another lucrative character, but just when she's about to buckle from stress, she's attacked on the street by Little Slugger, a grinning boy of maybe 11 or 12 who rides around on rollerblades and wields a baseball bat. Almost instantly, her case is being followed by the cops, sleazeball reporters, and yammering TV pundits. But the attack on Tsukiko is just the beginning. Soon, Little Slugger claims other victims, and Paranoia Agent starts opening up like an origami flower in water. The story encompasses more and more aspects of Japanese life, from memories of the atomic bomb to its deliriously silly popular culture. And meanwhile, the exploits of Little Slugger enter the national mythology, prompting a collective outpouring of speculation and gossip, rather like a Greek chorus.
Golden Slugger still hasn't been arrested, has he?
You mean Little Slugger?
Oh, yeah, Little Slugger.
I heard that his bat is golden.
So anyway, the police came to my place, too. It felt just like I was in a TV cop show.
So what did they ask you?
Well, they showed me this sketch of the suspect, and he looked like he was 12.
What? He was an elementary school kid? Really?
So then he really does have a twisted metal baseball bat?
But did you hear this? He grins right before he attacks.
That's so weird.
I heard his shoes and bat are both gold.
What if his eyeballs are also gold?
It's scary, not funny.
Yes, I know. The dubbing is pretty bad. But the DVD also lets you watch the show in the original Japanese with English subtitles, which is what I'd recommend. I myself have seen Paranoia Agent both subtitled and dubbed, once to hear the original acting, and once just to concentrate on the images. For Satoshi Kon is a brilliant stylist who weds a gorgeous sense of composition to a bold willingness to flip between past and present, objective reality, and subjective experience. While Paranoia Agent is unlike any TV show I've ever seen, The closest may be something like Twin Peaks. It's a logical extension of Kahn's three earlier animated movies, all available on DVD, and each of them terrific. His debut, Perfect Blue, was a psychosexual thriller about a pop idol haunted by a fan who can't accept her retirement. His follow-up, Millennium Actress, told the story of 20th century Japan through the career of a woman movie star. And his most recent picture, Tokyo Godfathers, was about three homeless people who look after an abandoned baby. What all these movies share is a fascination with the power of psychological projection, be it the worship of pop icons or the stigmatization of outsiders, like the homeless, who come to represent what society finds threatening. This same theme runs through Paranoia Agent. As the story progresses, what looks like a simple crime story, a young hoodlum whacking people with a ball bat, grows trickier and trickier. And we start to ask ourselves questions. Are little sluggers victims really victims, or do they secretly want to be attacked because this offers a kind of relief? Is little slugger a real person, or could he actually be an evil spirit born of repression? And what's his relationship to Tsukiko's creation, that big-eyed puppy Moromi, whose sole function in the world is to be soothingly innocent? At a time when Japanese culture may be best known for unthreatening creations like Hello Kitty and the flat paintings of Takashi Murakami, Kahn does something daring. He reveals the fear, sadness, and pain hidden by the modern embrace of things that are cute. In fact, for all its wild twists and turns, Paranoia Agent is shot through with a wistful sense of melancholy. Kahn has a keen awareness of human frailty and solitude in a modern society where individuals are surrounded by people and messages, yet feel utterly alone. In such a reality, Kahn suggests, paranoia isn't just a curse, but almost a necessity. Fear of little slugger is a way of feeling connected to a world that might otherwise have no meaning at all.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed the Japanese TV series Paranoia Agent, which has been released on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA Craft, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Martin Short's fat, fawning, and misinformed celebrity interviewer Jiminy Glick now stars in the new film Jiminy Glick in La La Wood. On the next Fresh Air, Martin Short talks about creating the character. Join us for the next Fresh Air.